Okay, well, good afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for coming to this, the first of our afternoon series of RESOP seminars for this summer term. And what I'm going to do is talk about kind of being commissioned and what that means. It all sounds very nice being commissioned. It all sounds very attractive, but actually there are issues with that, of course, to do with artistic integrity. And so the first thing to think about then is this, really. And this is just a little introduction to me, really. Well, you know, I'm in love. I'm in love with the natural world. And love hurts, as someone once famously said. And the thing about being in love with the natural world is this. The more you are in love with the natural world, the more you find that you are led to dislike, to begin with, human beings. And your dislike can lead in the end to disgust. Because as you investigate more and more the beauties and wonders of the natural world, you are thrown back all the time upon the way that that is interacted upon by the human world. And in fact, it's very clear within a few moments of thinking about natural beauty that you realise that the world would be much better off in many ways without mankind on it, without human beings. Human beings are in many ways a plague, a pest, a virus on the planet. And this is why we have this kind of dysfunctional relationship with what we think of as nature. We are part of nature, actually. We are animals, but we continually deny our animalistic nature, think we are superior simply because there are so many of us. We think we are the most superior species on the planet, when in fact we are not. We're just the most numerous. There are many more organisms living extremely successfully. Very few other organisms on this planet are leading a life that is going to lead to their own mass destruction, which in fact is actually what we're doing. So what happened to me is this then. And the question is this: how should artistic practice react to environmental threat? Since environmental threat is clear and obvious, you know, we don't need to make an argument about that. There are too many human beings, there are going to be more, and we are systematically wrecking the biosphere for profit, basically. So the question is, what should the correct artistic response be to those conditions? How do we respond to environmental threat? Well, I was commissioned then to write a libretto called The Angry Planet. And this happened because I worked with a composer called Bob Chilcott. And Bob said to me, I went down to London to hear the Bach Choir sing a carol that Bob and I had written, actually. And Bob said to me, just as we were walking out, oh, man, just need a quiet word. And I thought, oh, I wonder what I've done wrong. And he said, how would you like to be commissioned to write, you know, a big piece, a 45-minute piece for the Bach Choir? And after that, I of course said yes. And after that, there was a meeting in London. So many stories have, there was a meeting in London and we had lunch. And at this lunch meeting in London, there was David Hill from the Bach Choir, who was the key commissioner, I suppose. There was Bob, the composer, and myself as the chap who was going to write the words. And I was told it was going to be called The Angry Planet. And for quite a long time, I fought that title. I didn't want it to be called The Angry Planet. I don't like the title. The planet is not angry at all, of course. The planet could not care less. We should be angry about what we have done to the planet, and perhaps we're not angry enough. But I didn't particularly like the planet. But at that meeting, it became clear that this commission had within it a whole series of conflicts. So, for example, I was told that the tone of the piece was going to be angry. We want it to sound like the side of a mountain, I was told, which was, you know, really clear instructions. We want it to sound like this. It's got to be angry. It's got to be visceral. It's got to be a monumental piece. Oh, but by the way, there are children in it. So it had to be angry, but it had to be upbeat at the end as well. At the end, we want a really great piece, a bit like, you know, I'd like to teach the world to sing. We'd like something at the end that everybody can sing along with, something that's positive, something that's powerful. So it's going to be angry but upbeat. It was going to address adult themes of global significance and potential mass extinction events, but oh, there were children in it, and so it couldn't be too serious, because the children were, you know, they were primary school children, and they had to have things to sing that they could feel comfortable with. So that was another potential conflict. There was the political agenda of environmental disaster, and on the other side of that, there was the artistic agenda of writing something that had real profound impact, something that was a serious work of art. Of course, underneath all of those things that I was being given, there were my own personal hopes and aspirations for what I was going to produce. And I kind of quite wanted it to be good. Now, my personal aspiration that I should write something good that worked. And of course, as I'm addressing you today, my professional capacity, there were professional targets and strategic objectives that my university would like me to meet as well. So all of these things, satisfying the stakeholders, satisfying the client, satisfying myself, satisfying the university, all those things were swimming around in a kind of a conflict. So how do you solve those things then? How did I solve all those conflicts? Okay, so number one, I decided that the overall kind of tone of the piece would actually not be angry at all, because I don't really have that kind of anger in me. It would be a compassionate piece. It would be compassion for what we have already lost and what we might lose if we're not very careful. And therefore, it would have compassion in it, and it would have wonder in it. Because I realised that it had to be a piece that I had kind of delight in it. Because essentially, I'm a kind of praise poet. I'm a celebration poet. And I knew it had to have wonder and compassion rather than anger. So I rather ignored the instruction to be angry, frankly. I just kind of ignored that. Kept the title, but then actually wrote a kind of elegy. I decided that it would have an overarching narrative thread. That there should be, the whole thing should be connected. It should have some kind of artistic, coherent unity to it. And therefore it would have a forest setting. It would be a night journey from evening towards dawn, because dawn gave me a slight moment of promise at the end. And I also knew that in that narrative, there would be encounters with animals who would speak. And therefore, it would be a kind of dream narrative. I was drawing here on dream Anglo-Saxon dream narratives, actually, like Piers Plowman, where, you know, Piers the Plowman goes to sleep and he has a dream vision. And I knew I was going to have a kind of everyman narrator who was going to go to sleep and have dream visions. And in these dream encounters with animals, the animals would address him and say things like, "Look, what are you doing?" And I knew that if there was anger, I could put the anger in the mouth of the animals, and that's where I could get away with it, because I could use moments of what we call dramatic monologue. I could put words into the mouths of the animals and wear a mask, and I could use the animals to say things I wanted to say. And there would perhaps be a much more hard-hitting political dimension by using that aspect. I also decided that I would write some rebellious material just for the children, naughty things. I decided that the animals would be mournful, but I realised that there are also things, you know, there are parts of the planet that do not care what happens to mankind. And weeds, for example, you know, weeds will carry on being terribly successful millions of years after the human beings are extinct on this planet. So, you know, dandelions, brambles, nettles, daisies, things like this. You know, plants, beetles, ants, quite a lot of insects actually, can survive all kinds of mass catastrophe events. So I decided to write some kind of naughty, cheeky poems spoken by weeds, who would essentially stick two fingers up at mankind. And I decided I would give those to the kids, because if there's one thing that you know, primary school children understand. Actually, it's being naughty. There's a real pleasure and love in being mischievous. And I knew they'd love that. I mean, if by the way, we had a whole series of workshops, and I went into the school to work with the you know, these kids, as I'm calling them, these really young people. And if you say to them, okay, I want you to imagine you're a global catastrophe, they just look at you. But if you say, I want you to imagine you're a dandelion, they go, I'm a flower, you know, and they love that. So I decided to write some rebellious material for the children. Dandelions, daisies, nettles. I also decided to write, lastly, some really bitter, vicious songs with darkly ironic overtones that would be overtly pessimistic in the message that they gave. And what happened then, in the end, was we had three levels of writing. The dream vision material, the kind of weed riddles, really, and the dark, bitter songs. And we allocated those to different areas of the choir, because the challenge for Bob Chilcott was, I've got 590 people singing. How can I use the forces wisely with this material? How can I allocate material? So we gave the weed poems to the pupils from local primary schools. We gave the dream narrative to the Bart Choir and to the National Youth Chorus. And we gave this really bitter adult material to the BBC singers. Because, of course, the writing, the musical language, was also in different levels. The kids had to have songs that they could sing, that they could remember, that were easy, that were catchy, that were in a way straightforward. The BBC singers, as the only professional group there, could handle much more challenging musical material. And so that's what Bob gave to them. So we had a whole series of musical levels reflecting the literary levels of the writing. And I give you some examples of those now. So what I propose to do now is just give you an example of each of those levels from the libretto itself. So let me start with, you know, let's start with the very first piece, really, which is the dream narrative. So it became an environmental cantata. There were four movements, and the very first movement was a dream narrative piece which introduces the night journey and introduces the first animal encounter. And the first animal that's encountered is a slow worm. I decided to have different kinds of animals encountered, and I decided to have different kinds of environmental threat experienced by those animals. So, for example, there's a wildcat. That's one of the most threatened species in the UK at the moment. Slow worms are not that threatened, but they might be one day. It's the kind of thing, slow worms are the kind of thing that you don't think about until one day there aren't any left. They're kind of quietly hidden. 6 p.m. Each piece has a time. By an English wood one evening as I rested, where fields come down to drink from a green river, and blackbirds bring the dark in with their song. A slenderness swayed and curved of its own accord, like a stream the grass gave way for. And there was the blunted stem of a lowly slow worm. And the slow worm says, there's a taste of silence in the grass, like a winter we never wake up from, where all the world is emptied of us forever. And the field was suddenly thronged with a great crowd, looking for something they'd lost and could not find. And sorry, sorry, sorry too late, as always. So that's an example of the dream vision poems. Let me give you an example by way of a contrast of what I wrote for the children. And each of these flower riddles, we didn't use the title of what the flower was, so you can play a little game here and guess what this is at the end. And of course, these are based on Anglo-Saxon riddles. This one's called yellow eye. We open a yellow eye into the sun. When our lashes blow away, we are dimpled moons or bald old men gone blind. We point the neat arrows of our leaves in all directions at once, because we intend to be everywhere. Our roots go down to the first days of earth. We flew our seeds before the invention of birds. Although you do not like us, we are here to stay. In time, we shall grow over you completely. Offers? What's that? What flower is that? Dandelion. You're so good. So, and by the way, these local school pupils loved these weed poems. Absolutely adored them. So now let me give you a much darker poem then. The BBC Singers. The real bitter stuff. This is a poem that imagines a flood has taken place. Polar ice caps have melted. A huge flood has taken place. England and Ireland are now underwater. And someone terribly rich, because of course it's the rich who survive, they have the bunkers. Somebody terribly rich is kind of gently sailing along in their yacht, having a G&T on the poop deck. And they're asking the question, remember those islands? Those islands the waves washed over? Where were they exactly? Who lived there? And what were they like? It's water under the bridge. It's water over our heads. It's a land that's drowned forever. If only we had a raven, we could send him out until he came back with an oak leaf. If only we had a dove. So I wrote these kind of three different kinds of material. Well, I did not know when I wrote this material, I didn't know that this was going to turn out to be a BBC prom. About after I'd written it, really, while Bob was writing the music, he kind of said, oh, we're hoping to get it in the proms, because the chap who was the then conductor of the BBC, the Bach Choir, David Hill, had worked very closely with the BBC and the BBC Singers for a number of years, and he, as it were, had the ear of the controller of Radio 3. And eventually it was confirmed to me that this was indeed going to be part of the BBC proms, but I was told straight away, when I was being told that I couldn't tell anybody. So they said, it is going to be in the proms, but you mustn't tell anybody, which was really difficult. So I had to keep the lid on that, because the BBC don't like anyone knowing until the programme is announced in April. So in performance, of course, at the Royal Albert Hall, let's be honest, this all turned out very nicely, and I loved it, you know. By the time we got to that stage, months and months after I'd written it, because the words were written first and then the music, by the way. By that stage, it was all lovely. There was David Hill, there was the Bach Choir, the BBC Singers, the Notting Hill Chorus, these choirs of local school children. There was a choir who signed the words, which was amazing. Looked all very beautiful, because sign language is rather beautiful, actually. And there was a solo soprano. And it was all rather lovely, apart from the babies crying. But there we are. So that was great. But the thing about performances are, they're gone. Like that, they're gone. So legacy, you know, last year, there was a lot of talk about legacy because we had the Olympics. And so, you know, the legacy of that. Well, conclusion then. In conclusion and legacy. It seems to me that overt responses to threats tend towards immediacy rather than subtlety. In other words, what I mean is this. If you write an overt political piece in response to environmental threat, you tend to write journalistic pieces rather than poetry. You know, what can poetry do? There are certain things poetry can do and certain things it can't do. At one stage, of course, poetry used to do everything, long before we had newspapers, long before we had novels. Poetry did everything. Now, its functions are more restricted because we have other kinds of media that have replaced those functions for poetry. So I wanted to make sure that I wrote something that was, as it were, subtle, that had some beauty in it, that had some wonder in it, that had some yearning in it, that had some sadness in it, really. The other thing that I learned that was very useful is that a song is not a poem. So what happens is material you are writing to be sung differs quite strongly sometimes from material you are writing to speak aloud. You have to think that 590 voices are going to sing those words, not all at the same time. So you have to be prepared for your words to kind of take second place to music, if I'm honest. And you have to think about how you are going to create a song and craft a song rather than write a poem. And songwriting, something I've been doing a lot of course, with Bob, has much more of a craft element to it. You know, much more verse, chorus, how am I going to make this work as a song? The other thing I realised was that in environmental terms, I wasn't raising awareness, because we all know very well that the climate has changed. We know that. And we know that the climate is continuing to change, and not for the better. We know that today, here, on the 21st of May, when we haven't got the kind of weather we should have. We know, actually, that the impact of human beings on the planet is detrimental. We know that. So it wasn't so much, you know, raising awareness as expressing disgust, I suppose, on my part. But balancing that kind of disgust, I suppose, was this attempt to recognise the wondrous before it disappears forever. Because at least you can say, look, wasn't that amazing? Or isn't this amazing and isn't it worth protecting? So, for example, we do, you know, sometimes human beings can be great. We've got fantastic conservation programmes. We have, we've had quite a lot of success with rivers. The otter population in the UK is doing well and flourishing. But other populations, farmland songbirds have declined 70% since 1960, you know. Moths, by the way, have declined 70% since 1980. Butterflies are also on the decrease. So are bees and other pollinators, as we know. So we know that things are bad. It seemed to me there's no point me saying to the audience, ooh, aren't things bad? Because we know that. So therefore, it seemed my job to kind of raise awareness of the wondrous, if you see what I mean, not of the condition of the planet. The other positive outcome, of course, in terms of legacy, was that it turned then into another kind of commission. It turned into another kind of collaboration, because we decided, or some friends of mine, God bless them, offered. A friend of mine who's a publisher, whose wife is an artist, said, we'd love to publish the text of The Angry Planet with illustrations. So it turned into this rather dinky little book with an introduction by Bob Chilcott, all of the poems, woodcut illustrations, and a kind of commentary at the back about every single one of the poems. And of course, we sold these at the events. We gave them to parents, and, you know, it would have been nice to have given them to the pupils as well, but that didn't quite happen. But in terms of legacy, and in terms of course, impact for my employer and for the university, it seemed to me quite important that we captured the ephemeral nature of a performance in something more substantial, such as an ISBN publication. So we do have that, and we are, of course, carrying on with various other impact enhancement activities such as this. So I can finish there. I'm very sorry we didn't have the presentation slides. I'm sorry that there was no internet connectivity, because someone's cut the wire between Park and Avenue. But there we go. That was me, Bob Chilcott, and The Angry Planet. Thank you very much. Thank you.